You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We've got a great episode lined up for you today. We talk to Brighton icon and crime writer Peter James about everything from writing routines to stage plays and the recent ITV adaptation of his Roy Gray series. We also learn how he released the first ever electronic book. We talked to former Brighton resident Anne Gerd Harry about her career as a self-published author and her nomination for the Kindle Storyteller Award. And I discussed this month's book club book, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zavian, with two readers and book lovers, Laura Price and Lucy Hauft. The book club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. You can stay in touch with us over on Instagram at btnbookclub and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Our next episode will be our annual Christmas special, where we recommend a plethora of wonderful books. But before that, enjoy the show, and here is Peter James. Peter James is a UK number one best-selling author, best known for writing crime and thriller novels, and the creator of the much-loved detective superintendent Roy Grace. With a total of 19 Sunday Times number ones under his belt, he has achieved global book sales of over 21 million copies to date and has been translated into 38 languages. Peter James, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you've written 35 novels, but I'd like to go back to the beginning. Where did it all start with your writing?
It started when I wrote The Great British Novel. I'd always wanted to be a writer. When I was 17, my dad gave me the best birthday present ever, which was a little small portable electric typewriter and this absolute dragon of a lady who came to teach me to touch type. And she stood over my shoulder and she covered up all the keys so I couldn't see them. And if I looked down, she'd hit my fingers with a ruler. Say, don't look. But it taught me how to type fast. And I'd always had an ambition to write. So I thought, right, I had an idea for a book when I was 19. And I wrote it. And I was absolutely convinced this was probably the greatest novel ever written. Luckily, nobody else in the publishing world did. It didn't get published. And I wrote a second book that didn't get published and a third. And I sent it to everybody. And in those days, we didn't have email. You had to physically print the book out, 400 pages, bind it, mail it. And I went to film school and I came out in 1970 and it was impossible to get a job. And I had an uncle in Canada and he said, it's all starting up over here. Come out here. So I went to Toronto and I got a job working on a daily program for preschool children called Polka Dot Door. And I was what's called a gopher, which is, you'll know the term, the lowest human life form on a television set. And I'd been there about 3 months running errands. And the producer came in a panic one day and said, the writer's sick. We don't have a show today. I just read your CV. You won your school poetry prize. Can you write the show today? And they sat me in a corner with a little IBM golf ball selectric typewriter. And I wrote the show and they liked it. And they hired me to write it 3 days a week for the next year, which was a great break. I'd got an agent at that point, and I wrote to him. And I said, I got this great job writing television. And he wrote back. He said, you did you want to be a novelist? You really think you're going to sit and write children's television all day, then go home and write a book in the evening? He said, go work in a library or a factory. Do something where you're not using your creative brain. And he was quite right. I didn't write a book for 7 years. I was working in television and then in film. And I came back to England, and I met my then-to-be wife. And she said, well, ever since we've talked, you've been telling me about writing a book one day. When are you going to write one? And I read an article that there was a shortage of spy thrillers. Ian Fleming had died, and I thought I could write a spy thriller. So I did. I kind of pretty much made it all up. Called Dead Letter Drop. I'm only giving the titles to make sure nobody listening ever buys it, because it was terrible. But to my amazement, it got me a new agent. It got me a two-book publishing deal. And to my even bigger amazement, it didn't sell. It did disastrously. And I had the second book did even worse. And I was really despondent. And I poured my heart out to a friend of my then wife's sister who worked for Penguin. And she said, darling, why on earth are you writing spy thrillers? What can you ever know about the world of spies? You know, you're up against people like John le Carré who've come out the security services. So people who read are intelligent. They don't just want a story. They want to know, learn something about the world that the book is set in. It was amazing advice. And literally about a week later, my wife and I got burgled. And a young detective came to take fingerprints. And he saw my first two books. And he said, oh, he said, if you ever need research help with the police, give me a call. And a guy called Mike Harris, and he was at John Street in Brighton. And he was married to a detective called Renata. My then wife and I became friendly with them, and they invited us one day to a barbecue at their house, and there were 12 of their friends there, and they were all cops. Right across the field, there were traffic, response, homicide detective, SOCO. And just talking to them, I thought, you know, nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a police officer. And that was the starting point for me writing crime.
Once you started writing crime, did it kind of snowball from there? Because your books have been immensely successful. Was that when you first really felt success as a writer?
It was starting to. I wrote my first successful book called Possession, which came out in 1987. And it was more supernatural than crime, but it had police in it. And then as I got to know the police more and more, and these new sort of friends of mine in the police, when they realized I was seriously, genuinely interested, not just out to get a story I could flog to the Argus, they'd start sort of saying, well, come spend a day with us on patrol. And it got to a point by about the mid-1990s where I was putting police characters more and more into, I was writing psychological thrillers then, denial, the truth. And they liked how I was portraying them. And one day this a policeman's friend said, oh, there's a really interesting homicide detective. He's actually operating out of Hove Police Station at the moment, but you might like to meet him. And his name was Dave Gaylor. And I always remember going in his office, and I've never seen an office that was such a mess in my life. It was just a mass, blue and green boulder bins, bulging with manila folders. And I could just see this balding dome at the back. And I said, oh, are you moving? And he said, no, he said, I'm a homicide detective, but I've just been tasked with reopening all the unsolved murders in Sussex where there's still a chance of catching the perpetrator or where we could get closure from the family. And he said, each one of these crates is the principal, have the principal case files. I am the last chance each victim has for justice and that the families have for closure. And I really liked that human image about him. And he said to me, what are you writing at the moment? And I was halfway through this novel, Denial. He said, tell me about it. So I started telling him the story. I said, hang on a sec. Why is your character doing that? And why hasn't your detective got an outside inquiry team looking into this? And he started firing these questions at me. And I thought, wow, this guy has got a really creative side to him. And we became friends. And between 1997 and 2002, Dave rose to become Detective Chief Superintendent, effectively head of homicide for Sussex Police. My publishers at the same time spoke to me and they said, have you ever thought of writing a detective as a central character? So I went to Dave and I said, how would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved it. And he is my real life Roy Grace. Roy doesn't look like him, but Dave and I worked together closely on every book. And I think that's really helped the success of the books, because what he's given me is what it's like to really be a homicide detective, somebody who is dealing with the most horrific things, not just only how they deal with it, but somebody who goes home from a dismembered body and has to bath and put his own kids to bed and have dinner with his wife. That kind of whole life, I think we tend to pigeonhole police. We look at a uniform cop, we just see the uniform. We look at a detective, we see the sharp suit. We don't see the guy who's singing a goodnight song, lullaby to his newborn baby.
Yes, that's so interesting. And I think that as soon as you tap into that kind of human nature of people and the protagonists, your audience is instantly captured. So, Peter, you wrote the world's first electronic novel. Can you tell us about that? I was fascinated.
Yeah, I was doing some research at Sussex University in the cognitive sciences department for a novel I wrote called Host, for this novel. Host was probably the only science fiction book I've written. It's not really sci-fi because it was set in the time of 1993 when I was writing it. But the theme of the book was a computer scientist who wanted to live forever by the point of death, having his brain downloaded into a computer and his body frozen. So at some point, his body could be thawed out and his brain uploaded again. And they were at Sussex University at that time. They were quite advanced in sort of artificial intelligence. And I was working with two geeks, basically, at the uni. And one of them said to me, he said, do you know anybody that might be interested in putting money for an internet company? Now, just a preamble, I had about a week before, I'd been at Milton Keynes judging a short story competition. And I met, there was a one of the prize winners, her boyfriend was a Canadian computer scientist at the Open University. And he came up to me and said, "You ever use the net for your research?" Bear in mind, this was beginning of 93. I said, "I'm sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about." He said, "What are you researching right now?" And I said, "I'm researching cryonics, the science of freezing, low temperature freezing human bodies." He said, I could do a trawl on the net for you and send you anything I find, if that would help. I said, "Sure, thank you." I gave him my address, thinking that was the end of it. 3 days later, this enormous jiffy bag arrived with the names of 250 organizations around the world involved in cryonics research. And this would have taken me a year, if not longer. So I was at Sussex University with this knowledge, this amazing new contraption called the internet. And these two geeks said to me, we have this idea to put Sussex online, the first internet connection. And there were only two companies online in England at that time. There was Daemon and there was Pipex. I said, "Do you know anybody that might put up money for that?" And I said, "Do you have a business plan?" And they said, "Sure, we'll send it to you." And I thought I'd get something written on the back of a fag packet. And 2 days later, this 80-page business plan arrived for Sussex's first connection to the internet called Pavilion Internet. And I could immediately see the potential. And they wanted, at that time, £100,000. So I went to two mates and I said, "We should do this." So we put the money up between us. We opened up at the old Steen, tiny office. We had within about first 6 months, we got about 2,000 clients. And it kind of went on from there. We sold it to EasyNet in about 98, but it was huge fun and huge. I learned so much from it. Pavilion, within about 10 days of a starting operation, we had a phone call from Birmingham Police saying, "One of your customers is downloading kiddie porn. Could you give us his IP address and everything?" And we were joined by a third geek, ex-Sussex University, and all three of them said, "Absolutely not. We cannot breach confidentiality." And we had a row for about a week, and we finally did. And the police arrested this guy, and he ended up in prison. And it made me realize that the internet was, whilst it was a fascinating research tool, it wasn't just the information superhighway, it was going to be a proper digital dirt track as well.
And you released this book onto floppy disk, didn't you?
Yeah, so the book was being published by Penguin in the usual hardback, paperback format. And Andy, one of the guys, rang me and he said, "Why don't you get your publishers to publish this on electronic format?" And I said, "Is that possible?" And he said, "Yeah, there's technology that's being developed that it wouldn't be difficult." And I said, "Well, what do you think it could cost?" And he said, "I think we could probably do it for between £5,000 and £10,000. So I said, "Okay, I'll speak to my publishers." So I phoned this guy, Andy Wellum at Penguin, who was the head of marketing. And I got the fastest yes I've ever known in my life. I mean, within an hour and a half, he came back to me and said, "We do it." The book was published on two floppy disks on Mac and PC platforms. It was a bit wobbly. And instead of the standard author photo, you could click on a button and you got a quick time of me for about 20 seconds talking about the book like this.
My gosh, how things have changed in this funny old publishing industry. So let's talk about your latest Roy Grace book. Where is Roy in this novel?
Well, Picture You Dead is a story about something that's close to my heart. My wife, Laura, and I have always been keen car boot sale attendants. We love going to them and picking up stuff. And also, I think everyone of us who ever goes to car boot sale has that sneaking hope that one day you might just pick up something that's insanely valuable. And it doesn't happen for most of us. But in my book, Picture Your Dad, couple, he's a builder, she's a teacher, and they go to a car boot sale at Sayers Common one Sunday, and they buy this horrible painting. They love the frame. And they buy that, they're going to cut the painting out and put something they like in it. And they buy it for 20 quid, get it home. And then they realize there's something else underneath, another painting. They clean the surface painting off and they take it to Antiques Roadshow. And the guy at Antiques Roadshow says, "Look, I can't tell you for sure right now that this is genuine or not." He said, "But this looks like a long-lost Fragonard from 1770. And I can tell you the last Fragonard sold at auction for £17 million. And that's where their nightmare begins. And they start to discover that there is a very sinister world behind the kind of veneer of the respectable art world, where people are prepared to murder, where forgeries become indistinguishable from real paintings. It's a world of wonderful skullduggery, and Roy Grace has to go on a fast learning curve to suddenly learn about the world of London art dealers. And we're very lucky. Well, I was very lucky in my research, because one of the world's top art forgers, a guy called David Henty, who's in the book as a very thinly veiled version of himself, totally with his approval, lives in Salt Dean. He and his wife were just so brilliantly helpful to me.
Can we hear some, please, Peter?
Sure. I thought it'd be kind of fun just to read a little bit about when they go to Antiques Roadshow, which is painting they bought and just cleaned up. Saturday, the 28th of September, at 10 a.m., Harry and Freya Kipling had been marshalled along with all the others, now numbering well over 1,000, into various queues. Theirs was for the picture expert. In spite of their early arrival, a good 150 people were in front of them, and the queue was moving at a slow pace. The sun, already high in the sky, was beating down, and Harry, perspiring, wished he'd bought a hat and had stuck with a T-shirt and his trademark shorts, rather than opting to dress a bit fancy in a cream linen suit. Freya had been more sensible, looking gorgeous in straw hat, simple sundress, and espadrilles with a blue bow on them. On either side stood lines of people clutching objects, the good, the bad, and the complete tat. Harry said to Freya, "You know, the one thing I always find fascinating about this show is the expressions people have on their faces when they get told the value of what they've brought along." "Me too," she said, "especially the ones who look so clearly disappointed when they're told it's worth 50 quid, when they were expecting to be told it's worth many thousands. Let's try not to look disappointed or too excited." Harry and Freya suddenly heard a loud tut-tut behind them and a horsey female voice explaining, "Ridiculous, the way they organise this." Unsure who she was addressing, they turned to see a small, rotund woman in her late 60s, silver hair in a bun, tweed skirt, stout shoes. She was clutching a painting protectively to her chest. "God knows what rubbish people have brought along," she said, and tapped the back of her canvas. "They really ought to separate us into those who have something clearly genuine and those who have an obvious waste of everyone's time." "Well, I guess they have no way of knowing till the experts see it," Freya replied pleasantly. "What's the painting you have?" Harry asked. "It's been in my family 3 generations, she said haughtily, holding it up quite furtively, as if for them to give them a sneak peep. It was a wooded landscape with trees and water in the foreground and a Gothic cathedral with a tall spire beneath dark clouds in the background. "That's beautiful," Freya said. "Indeed, and so it should be, given its provenance." "Well, what do you know about it?" Freya asked, lowering her voice as if not wanting to be overheard by the people behind her. She mouthed, "It's a constable, John Constable. You've heard of the Haywayne?" "Of course," Freya said. She gave him a very smug smile. "Well, this is one of the paintings he did of Salisbury Cathedral." "Wow," Harry said, "you've never thought of putting it into an auction with one of the major houses?" "Oh, yes, but I've heard what a lot of rogues there are in the art world, so I thought I'd get its authenticity proven by Oliver de Souter. He's the paintings expert here today, renowned authority on old masters. And then, of course, we will take it straight to Sotheby's." "How wonderful," Harry said, and he waited for her to ask a question about their painting, but she didn't. Instead, she said, I don't suppose you'd let me go in front of you. I really would like to Mr. de Souter to see this before he gets jaded by too much rubbish."
That's such a great scene. Thank you so much. So before we go, and I have so many questions for you, Peter, but I'm going to really have to try and rein myself in here. You clearly research your books so extensively. Do you have any really good facts about Brighton that you can share with us?
I one of my favourite facts about Brighton is it is the only place in the UK where a serving chief constable of police was murdered in office.
Wow.
It was in, I think, 1847, a guy called Henry Solomon, and he was in the old police station underneath the town hall, which is now the Police Cells Museum, which I'm actually vice president of. And they brought in this burglar, and he attacked Henry Solomon with a poker and killed him, and was hung 2 weeks later. That's one of my favorite Brighton facts.
That is morbidly fascinating. So many people listening will have watched ITV's adaptation of Grace, which is filmed in Brighton and has done so well. Congratulations. How much do you have, Peter, in the kind of writing and directing of it? And how does it feel to watch your book immortalised on screen?
In terms of how it felt, John, if I'd had to do a photo fit of Roy Grace when I'd first created him back in 2002, it would have been John Sim. So, and also Glenn Branson, Richie Campbell. So they've got the characters absolutely spot on. And ITV have been brilliant to work with. I mean, we're just filming the third series at the moment. And I spent an hour and a half on a Zoom call this morning with the creative team, just going through the script and some final tweaks before they start filming the next one in 10 days' time. So I'm involved on every single casting decision. So that relationship is immensely happy. And John Sim, you know, lives down in Brighton as well. And he's such a great guy. What I like, you know, I'm a stickler for getting police detail right. And his father-in-law was 35 years a copper in the Met and shouts at the screen at television shows when they get it wrong. So John's always had this extra vested interest in getting it right. And he's just the nicest guy and the most thoroughly professional actor I think I've ever worked with.
And your work hasn't only been adapted to screen, but also to the stage. Wish You Were Dead is now a stage play. How much did you have involvement in that?
A lot. I mean, the adaptation from my novella was done by Sean McKenna because it's a different skill set. And also I'm busy writing new books. But in terms of, again, I work very closely with the main producer, Josh Andrews, on going through endless drafts of the script and then the casting and the choice of venues. And of course, we're going to be back in Brighton on the week of March the 20th, which is very exciting. And I had my first stage play performed here in about 2015. And I went on stage at the Theatre Royal at the end. And I was in tears. Because my parents had regular seats at the theatre, about four rows back from the front, and would go every Thursday night. And from about the age of nine, throughout my childhood, I would go too. But I always wanted to be a writer. I would see that curtain rise, and I would dream that one day that curtain would rise and there'd be something there I'd written. So when it finally happened and I went on stage, I was choked.
Well, huge congratulations. I cannot imagine how wonderful that feels. Peter, why should everybody listening nab a Roy Grace book for their loved ones this Christmas?
Oh, well, I think if you love them, then you want to give them a good present. But I think if you enjoy reading, I try to make, with my Roy Grace books, as with everything I write, but Roy Grace is the main thing that I do. I write books that I want to read. I want to be gripped, but I want to be entertained. I want to laugh. And you know something, I also want to have a book that is not hard to read. So I tend to write, I don't write massively long, complex words. And I don't write long chapters. You know, I think most of us read a lot at night in bed and we're tired. And if I pick up a book and I see the chapter's 53 pages, I think, I'll try tomorrow. I think, oh, that chapter is only 1.5 pages. I'll have that. Oh, the next chapter, that's only 2 pages. And next thing I know, it's 3 a.m, I'm still reading. So I try to write books that I think will give people just proper pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us, Peter. It's been an honour.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Angad Harry, former Brighton resident and current KDP author. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Lovely. Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
Okay, so I started writing probably about 8 years ago, and I did it as a hobby. I grew up in the UK, and I've also lived in several different countries. I've lived in Norway, in the USA. Then we went back to the UK for a while, and now I live in France.
And for anyone who doesn't know who KDP are, what is KDP?
Well, I'll give you my view of KDP, okay? That may not be technically all correct, but for me, KDP is a platform on Amazon where you can publish your book and it can be available to millions of readers. It's as simple as that.
So Kindle Direct Publishing is self-publishing, essentially. And I'd really like to hear about what you've learned about the traditional versus the self-publishing industry. Did you try and get the book traditionally published to start with?
My first book, yes, I did try to get it traditionally published. I had what I'd say medium success because, you know, everyone who writes books knows that it's actually really difficult to get an agent and it's even more difficult to get a publisher. But yes, I did try that. And I had a couple of agents who were sort of interested, but it never got to a publishing contract. But it gave me enough confidence that those couple of people, and I didn't even speak to them. They sent me a little email to say, oh, yes, you know, send us the manuscript. And that's enough to give you a boost. Mm-hmm. So having those first contacts was very important. But in the end, I didn't get a publishing contract. And that's why I decided to publish myself. And my first three books, I published myself on KDP.
So when you become a self-published author, you have to kind of become a publisher, right? You are a designer and marketer and project manager of all these things. What was the kind of biggest wake-up call that you had when you started this self-publishing journey? What did you underestimate would be as much work?
Well, I would say, you know, pretty much everything. I mean, writing the book is a mammoth task, first of all, in itself. But then there's so much to do. You've got to format the book, have it in the correct format to put it onto KDP. You have to have a great cover design because that's the first thing that readers see when they're scrolling on the site. You've got to, you know, get reviews. I mean, there's a massive amount you need to learn. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of daunting. It is, and you have to learn it as you go along. But once you have published one book, for the second book, it's so much easier. You know how it works. You know what you've got to do. There's plenty of advice out there, plenty of authors and writers who are going to help you. There are lots of platforms you can join, Facebook, and plenty of groups that are going to help you do that. So although it seems like, okay, this is a mountain, now I've got to learn all these things, everyone, there's lots of people who are going to help you out. It's actually really not that complicated. Once you've done it a couple of times, it's not that complicated.
And what would you say you've noticed, Anne, are like the pros and cons of the traditional industry versus the self-publishing industry?
I think it depends on your personality. I mean, for me, I like doing things myself. And I don't especially enjoy giving control to other people. That's kind of a character flaw, I guess. But it makes me a good independent author because I did have a publishing deal later on. I published three books independently. And then my next books, I did pitch again to agents and publishers. I did have a small publishing contract for 3 years, and I now have those books back. And what I didn't enjoy about it was the lack of control about the editing, about the cover design, about how the book was going to be marketed. I mean, it's all out of your hands. If you were the big publisher, perhaps that's okay because you would have the revenue, you'd have some cash coming in. But I didn't enjoy that. I liked being controlled.
So you are now a career author, which is wonderful. Congratulations, because not many writers can say that. What was the kind of turning point of becoming a kind of writer and publishing as a hobby and becoming a career author?
I think it was something to do, well, it's to do with confidence, my own confidence in my writing. My own confidence as I grew a following and a readership who read your next book and are waiting for it to come out. It was also something to do with speed of writing. I mean, I said that, you know, that it took me 3 to 4 years to write that first book. Now I'd say it takes me about a year. And actually that is kind of slow. I mean, I do know, you know, people who write a lot, they can write, you know, 3 or 4 books in a year. I mean, that is never going to be me. But writing one book a year, doing all the publishing and the marketing. You know, there's also Amazon advertising to learn about, Facebook advertising, Instagram advertising. And there's so much you need to either master yourself or have somebody, friend, or employ someone to do it.
What would you say are your top tips for self-publishing?
Definitely know the market, which means reading a lot. I always loved reading anyway, so that worked for me. But know your market, know the niche that you want to work to write in. So I write crime, I like write psychological thrillers. I love reading crime. Know the other authors out there who are being successful. Read their books, read lots of their books. And it will show you the type of style you could write in. It will give you ideas about what you can do. And then I think a lot of it is also originality. I mean, too much originality can mean that your book will sink, but a little bit means that it's fresh and it's new and readers are going to like it. And I think learning that balance, you can only learn it, I believe, by sort of experience and by getting feedback on what it is you last produced.
And do you employ professional editors at this point in your career?
Yes, I have two. I have, and it's taken me a while to find those people because I used different people in the past. I have one person who does a thorough beta read for me, and she is absolutely great. She's in the States. And I also have a copy editor who goes through the final manuscript and sorts out all the problems.
So before I ask you about the woman in Room 19, let's talk about the Kindle Storyteller Award. How do you get nominated for the Kindle Storyteller Award? How is it chosen?
You put your book in yourself, you nominate your own book to the competition, and then what I understand is they create a shortlist for the finalists based on review ratings, what readers have actually thought of your book, how many ratings you have, and how the book has paid since it's been published.
And it's quite a big deal. The prize is a £20,000 marketing deal with Amazon, right? Mm. It's amazing. What kind of impact would that have on your books?
It would have a great impact because, you know, it's really the expertise. For me, yes, I mean, 20,000, that'd be absolutely fantastic. But for me, it's the expertise on marketing that would really boost my whole catalogue. It's always sort of the people who do the thinking that you want. It's the people's thinking you want. Or I want anyway, and what they know about marketing, what they know about presenting books to readers.
So let's talk about The Woman in Room 19, which is the book that is up for the Kindle Storyteller Award. What is this book about and how did the idea come to you?
Well, the book is about two couples who meet at the hotel, and all of the people in the book have a secret, and one of the couples isn't at all who they seem to be. So how did the I can't remember, how did the idea of the book come to me? Really, often ideas for books come to me from the characters. So there are four main characters in this book: Shannon and Jared, and Harry and Natasha. And really, the story came from who those characters are, what's happened to them in the past, what is the secret they're keeping, how did that come about, and how is it going to impact what's going on at the hotel? Because something unpleasant happens at the hotel, and they all react differently. And there are reasons for that. We find out those reasons.
It's really, really intriguing. And I'd love to hear a bit from it. So can you read us, please, from this?
Yes. So this is from the beginning of the book. I could help. The pool isn't so deep and the water is perfectly clear. I could take a breath and dive and reach out my arms, except I won't. Would you? Would you save someone who has taken away everything you hold dear? It's almost over. As my gaze locks onto theirs, I know they have understood. This is the end. In the final moments, their hair wafts gently and there are no more bubbles. I force myself to watch until their eyes glaze over and their hands relax. Only then is the nightmare over.
Oh, I've got shivers down my spine. So you write in the crime and thriller genre. For anyone that's listening that is interested in writing crime and thriller, what are your kind of main things to think about when you're plotting your books?
This is a tip actually that I learned a long time ago. I often plot by first of all thinking of the beginning, how's the book going to start off, and then the end. I know both of those two parts of the story. Mm-hmm. And then I do all the bits in between. And it really keeps it clear in my mind where I'm heading towards. I also do plot usually in quarters. So I have the beginning and the end. Mm-hmm. Then I split the book into four. Mm-hmm. So in the first quarter, you're introducing the characters, little quirks about them, a little bit about their history, but not too much history. Mm-hmm. And you're really coming in strongly with the premise of the story and the tension in the story. And then the second two quarters, if you like, some really bad things are going to happen if it's a crime. Perhaps another death, perhaps something really terrible from the past is going to come to light. And then, of course, the last quarter is how it's resolved. So that's my overall structure.
And who are some of your favourite writers to read when you're, you know, reading in your genre?
My absolute favourite is Karen Slaughter. My second favourite is Angela Marsons. But there is one book that I got to say is right at the top of the list, and that is Child 44 by Tom Robb-Smith. That has to be my favourite ever crime thriller.
So firstly, really, really good luck in the Kindle Storyteller Award. We will all have our fingers crossed for you. But before you go, I'd really like to hear about your experience of living in Brighton and being a writer in Brighton. Where were your favourite places to read and write in the city?
Well, I lived in Brighton for about 10 years, and my two favourite places, of course, the seafront. And there's nothing better than sitting with your back against that little wall, staring at the sea. And I'd say that a lot of plots went around my head at that time, because I would do my writing, I do all my writing at home, but my thinking I do in quiet places. Also, I do a lot of thinking when I'm walking. Mm. And one of my favourite walks was from Brighton to Rottingdean. I loved that.
And do you have any particular favourite books set in Brighton or written by Brighton authors?
I have read, just finish it, This Is Going to Hurt, by Adam Kay, who does live in Brighton, I believe. But he's one of the judges of the Brighton Kindle Storyteller Award this year. And he writes about his experience as a doctor. It's a very funny and also really poignant book.
Really, really good luck, Anne, with the Kindle Storyteller Award. And if anybody wants to find you and read copies of your wonderful books, how can they find them?
You can find my book in ebook format or paperback on Amazon. It's also available in Waterstones and or can be ordered in a bookstore. I'm on social media, Anne Good Harry, on Facebook, Instagram, and I also have my own website.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Our book club book this month is Gabrielle Zevin's Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. I often watch the progress of hyped books on Twitter and Instagram and in the kind of publishing press and try to read as many as I can. And sometimes they disappoint and they're completely overrated, and sometimes they absolutely don't. And this one for me absolutely definitely didn't. I adored this book. So unfortunately, Gabrielle can't join us today due to work commitments, but I'm delighted to be joined by two wonderful writers, Laura Price and Lucy Hauft, to talk about this book. So I am going to read the blurb and then I'm going to open it up to Laura and Lucy. Sam and Sadie meet in hospital in 1987. Sadie is visiting her sister. Sam is recovering from a car crash. The days and months are long there, but playing together brings joy, escape, fierce competition, and a special friendship. Then, all too soon, that time is over and they must return to their normal lives. When the pair spot each other 8 years later in a crowded train station, they are catapulted back to that moment. The spark is immediate, and together they get to work on what they love, creating virtual worlds to delight, challenge, and immerse, finding an intimacy in the digital realm that eludes them in their real lives. Their collaborations make them superstars. This is the story of the perfect worlds Sadie and Sam build, the imperfect world they live in, and of everything that comes after success: money, fame, duplicity, and tragedy. Welcome, Lucy and Laura, to the Brighton Book Club. I am going to ask you firstly to introduce yourselves, and we'll talk about your books properly at the end of this conversation, and then I'm going to ask you what you thought of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. So we'll start with Laura.
Hi, thanks for having me. My novel is called Single Bald Female and it came out in April 2022 in hardback, and it's out in January 2023 in paperback, and I guess I'll talk about the plot at the end.
Hi, my name's Lucy Hoped. I have a series of spy novels. The first one is called The King's Pawn and it's coming out next month with Burning Chair Books. It's set in Georgia and Azerbaijan, and the second one is coming out early next year as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's really nice to kind of sit with like passionate writers and readers and talk about books, because it is one of my favorite things to do, believe it or not. So I'm going to start and ask you, Laura, what did you think of this book?
I absolutely loved it. I wouldn't have come on this recording with you if I didn't love it. It was also really special to me because I read it in July, literally right after I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I just needed something that I was going to completely connect with and be completely immersed in. And it was exactly that. It just delivered. It just took me into this world. And for me, I don't know if you or your listeners have read A Little Life, but it really reminded me of A Little Life in the sense that it's a saga and it goes on for years and years, and we really get to know the characters and we feel like we've sort of lived their lives with them.
And had you, Laura, read any of Gabrielle's books before?
No, I had not. No, I think, you know, you said in the intro that it got a lot of hype and I heard about it because of the hype and picked it up. I couldn't not. And also seeing that cover and seeing it in the Waterstones with the old Ataris in the window display, I just couldn't not pick it up.
And Lucy, what did you think of this book?
Yeah, I also absolutely loved it. There was a moment I was reading it, I was probably about 20-30% through. You can tell I read on a Kindle. I suddenly had this moment of feeling incredibly vulnerable. I felt this book has me by the heart. You know, I am so engaged with these characters. And I know that drama and bad things will come because they do in books, and that's how it works. And she does quite a good amount of foreshadowing that stuff will happen. And I almost felt like I can't let myself be watch what's happening to these characters who I love, if it's not all going to be roses and lovely. And I don't remember the last time I felt that same feeling of, you know, these are deeply special and important people to me, quite so early on. A Little Life is a good comparison, but I sort of really didn't like A Little Life because it's so relentlessly horrible. And I loved the characters and I couldn't bear that the author was so mean to them. But it's that a similar feeling of being completely dragged into it because you care so much. But in this book, it's less punishing than A Little Life. Things happen, difficult things happen, but somehow I didn't feel as broken by it.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk a bit about nostalgia in the book, because for me, it really, I mean, it is set in the 90s and they were such kind of, in so many ways, I mean, simpler times, but obviously kind of technically more complex with the kind of world of game building. But it really took me back to just how kind of friendship and work and life is conducted before the internet as we have it today. And I'd love for both of you to kind of speak on what that sparked in you.
I was born in 1982, so the 90s were my era, and I had I asked my brother last night what computer console we had. Apparently we had an Amiga, but I'm convinced we had an Atari as well, and we used to play a lot of games together. I also had the Game Boy. I was obsessed with Tetris and Mario Brothers, and we had a game called Super Frog, which was a platform game, which I was just completely obsessed with. And I'm not a gamer, like, you know, I'm not now. It's many, 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 well, it's decades later. And I don't think that this book is just for gamers, but the 90s nostalgia is just brilliant. And yeah, I just loved that kind of that pre-internet era before, you know, before we could connect instantly with people all around the world. We had these games and it was fantastic.
And how about you, Lucy?
Yeah, so I'm very much a similar era. I was born in 1981. So yeah, lots and lots of nostalgia. The music references, the gaming references. Yeah, just the way life is. So yeah, similar. I, as a child, loved video games. So I had a Nintendo, definitely lots of Tetris, Mario Kart, Mario, Zelda, these sort of things, but have never seen it as something to engage in as a grown-up. You know, I sort of see it as like playing with Lego. It's something I loved, but is really not part of my life now. And that probably put me off starting the book initially, because I thought, gaming is just absolutely not something I'm going to be into. And that's one of the things that I think she does so brilliantly, is that you really don't have to be into gaming at all. And by the end, I almost felt like, wow, what an amazing art form. You know, maybe I should be more into gaming. She really sells it and describes why people get so excited about these things.
I couldn't agree more. And there's this quote that I love from the book, and it says, "What is a game?" Mark said. "It's tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's the possibility of infinite rebirth, infinite redemption, the idea that if you keep playing, you could win. no loss is permanent because nothing is permanent ever. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, this is kind of what gaming is and why people game. And unlike you both, like, I didn't grow up in or around games. I don't play games on my phone. And I remember once, like, really going in on a former housemate of mine and being like, why are you just gaming all the time? That's so lame. And I feel terrible now. And I have since apologized, because it is storytelling and it's connection. And it's something that people do together. And I know, especially in the last few years, you know, with lockdown and everything, that that was a really, really big way for people, young people and, you know, adults to connect. And I think this, the way that they tell the stories in the book, has made me really respect game building as an art form, where I definitely wouldn't before. So I'd love to talk a bit about friendship in the book. Something that it says in the blurb is, this is not a romance, but it is about love. Laura, what was it about the friendships in this book that really captured you?
We're allowed a bit of spoiler, right?
We can do mild spoiler.
Okay, so I think it was really interesting that it was a friendship triangle. I love the way the friendship, the main friendship is obviously about Sadie and Sam, but then Marks comes in. And I think we sort of automatically imagine that by bringing a third friend into that triangle, it's going to cause problems. And maybe it does on some level. But ultimately, I think instead of weakening the triangle, Marks strengthens it. And I won't give any more spoilers away than that, but I think the friendship triangle between the three of them is just really, really something special and exciting.
It feels very pure, doesn't it? And I think that it definitely really reminded me of some of the oldest friendships that I have, the ones where you don't really need to say anything. It's that kind of level of understanding that is implicit. Lucy, what did you make of the friendships in this book?
Yeah, very similar views. You know, you start off and obviously it's Sam and it's Sadie that you're most invested in. And when Marks comes along, he feels a bit like, you know, the fairy godmother who's just sort of making it work for them so that they can be passionate and into their world and not have to worry about kind of pragmatic stuff. But I think one of the things I found most interesting was his character arc from being the NPC, the, you know, non-playable character at the beginning, to really becoming the TOH. I don't know if we can even give away that spoiler. It's not really a spoiler, but it's such a lovely moment. But the, you know, the way he becomes so essential for them, he's the one who allows them to be the people they need to be. I did have a bit of a problem with some of the aspects of Sadie's character. I kind of slightly fell out of love with her as the book went on. I thought I loved her so much at the beginning, and then there were a few points when I was just like, what? And I found myself siding a bit more with the others because she was winding me up. But definitely the way you describe it, as old friends that you're just around, that know you inside out, that you don't even have to speak out loud to, there was that real feeling of these are people who need each other to be.
I really agree with you with the Sadie, you know, with your observation about Sadie. And I think she hardened. And I think she hardened because she is a woman in this, you know, in this very male dominated industry, and that she just felt like she was kind of constantly battered down by, you know, people's expectation or misrepresentation of her. Yeah, I mean, I thought the character arcs were beautifully done. I think that Sam and Sadie meeting when they are young, Sam is in hospital, Sadie's sister is in hospital, and really bonding initially over the gaming was just such a gorgeous way to kind of spark a friendship. And it's made me want to ask both of you, Lucy and Laura, how you navigate friendships in your own writing.
Well, actually, my book Single Bald Female is very much about friendship. So it's ultimately about a woman who is diagnosed with breast cancer and goes through a breakup at the same time, and she starts dating with a bald head. And we think that that's what the story is going to be about, but it's actually about someone who she meets in the hospital. And it's about the friendship arc through that. And also the idea that in our 20s and 30s, our friends all go down different paths. You know, some of them get married, have babies, others remain single, and that creates divides. But ultimately, it can also bring us back together in some ways. So I loved the way Sadie and Sam met in the hospital setting, because that's something that I've got in my own book. And also, I'm now going through breast cancer for a second time. And so I was literally spending lots of time in the hospital, and still am, when I read this book. So yeah, I love the idea that even though horrible stuff happens in hospitals, good stuff can happen as well, that can, you know, heal you. And I think there's a real healing storyline throughout the book as well for some of the characters.
Yes, absolutely. And the kind of breaking and mending and all of these things that actually you can see reflected in how games are built, you know, kind of coming to the end of one life, starting another one. And there's this kind of endless possibility that is reflected in the games in the book. How about you, Lucy? Let's talk about friendship in your books.
So, I mean, my character is a young female spy who's sort of absolutely chucked in the deep end. And so certainly in book one, it's a lot about being really on your own and without friends, and then realizing there's no one you can trust, realizing that the people you would normally confide in, you're not even allowed to talk to. And the distance that sort of brings to family relationship, to friends. So my main character has a best friend who has always, she's featured in the first book and second book, and she's always been edited out by needs to make it smaller or shorter, or, you know, get into the action more. And I've always been a bit sad. So book three, she has a really major role, because I was just really interested, you know, for me, close friends are such an important part of life, and they're such an important part of how you understand yourself. That I felt it was really important for my main character to have those relationships and to explore the difficulties that poses if you're a spy and you can't tell your best friend that you're a spy. So book three, her close female best friend, it becomes a major character, and her sort of using her and not respecting the friendship becomes part of the story arc.
I would love for both of you to tell me a little bit more about your books and also recommend anything you've read recently. One thing that I would like to recommend, if you liked Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and want to read something similar, is a book called The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clyde by Michael Chabon, which is an absolute masterpiece and is very structurally similar and not too dissimilar in time period, but it's about comic book writing as opposed to games. And I really think that if you love this book by Gabrielle's, you will love this book by Michael Chabon. So Laura, let's talk a little bit more about Single Bold Female and what you've read recently that you would recommend to our listeners.
Well, Single Bold Female, I mean, I just introduced, you know, the storyline. It's about a young woman who's diagnosed with breast cancer, and that was inspired by my own diagnosis of breast cancer 10 years ago and the kind of experiences that came from that. So the stuff that happens with your friendships, the stuff that happens with love and romance, also family and grieving, because the main character is grieving the loss of her mother. But having said that, it's also very funny and uplifting, so it's not like a sad throughout book, and that's what people have kind of reflected in the reviews as well, so that makes me very happy. In terms of book recommendations, so I can't remember now whether it's Sadie or Sam who is part Korean, but they share this Asian connection in the book, and currently I'm reading a book called Crying in H Mart by Michelle Zauner, who is a Korean-American writer, and it's a memoir about the death of her mother. And it's just fantastic, and it talks all about Korean food, and food is something that, you know, is something that I work with as well. And if I can mention a second one, I've just read The Proof of a book called Fling, which comes out in February 2023. It's by Joseph Murray, who is an Irish writer, and it is absolutely hilarious. It's about a married couple who have been going through IVF, and that's just kind of putting a lot of pressure on their relationship. And then they hear about this app which allows you to have an extramarital affair, and they both kind of go down this hilarious storyline with this app, and it's just brilliant. I think it's going to be big in 2023.
That sounds absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much. And I loved Crying in HMR. That's a really, really great suggestion. Thank you. How about you, Lucy? Tell us a bit more about your latest book and recommend a couple of ones for us to read.
So my book, The King's Pawn, is the first in a series of a young female spy, Sarah Black, and it is going to be a 5-book series. I've always imagined it as a kind of 5-act arc. So the first one, she's very young, she's very naive, she's sort of thrown in the deep end, has no idea what she's doing. It's set in Georgia and Azerbaijan in the South Caucasus, which is where I lived once upon a time, working for DFID, the UK Department for International Development. I left university, I joined the Foreign Office, and then I moved straight into DFID, and I went off to the former Soviet Union, and then to China, and then Sierra Leone. And so everybody always assumed I was a spy. So the books are a sort of what if, you know, obviously I wasn't, but what would that world have been like if I had been, and exploring some of those, yeah, the questions about what do you do if you can't confide in anyone, how do you trust when your whole world is lacking in trust, how do you fall in love when you're not allowed to be who you are, all that sort of thing. So yeah, that's coming out 17th of November next month, which is exciting and quite terrifying, as I'm sure you know. In terms of book recommendations, I have just, the last book that I was raving about was The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida, that's just won the Booker Prize, by Shahan Karimtulaka. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But I loved that. I picked it off the long list. I hadn't heard of it before, but when I saw it on the long list in the description, I thought that just sounds absolutely brilliant and I need to have a go at that. And I loved it. It's bonkers and it's hilarious and it's irreverent. And yet it's also, you know, about really serious subject matter, and it's a really biting satire, and it's told in the second person present mostly. So you're so into it, you know, you are the main character, which is a bit unnerving at first, but then you're completely thrown into the story. So I definitely recommend that. And yeah, a memoir, I'm actually reading a memoir at the moment called The Choice by Dr. Edith Eger. She's a Hungarian Auschwitz survivor who went on to become a psychiatrist. And it's about sort of how you can get through trauma, how you can deal with trauma, and how you can then help use your trauma to help others. And what I like about it is it's incredible, relentless optimism that you always have the choice. Everybody is subjected to trauma, to bad things happening. You have the choice about whether or not you can become a victim or whether or not you can move on. And just, you know, she's obviously been through something that is more awful than any of us can really possibly imagine. And the whole first third of the book is about her time in Auschwitz. And so moving on from there to how she rebuilds her life, it's a very, very inspiring read.
Thank you so much, Laura, and thank you so much, Lucy, for joining us. Hopefully we have encouraged you to pick up a copy of Gabrielle's wonderful book Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, preferably from your local bookshop, City Books, Kemp Town Books, Waterstones in Brighton, etc. But if not, it's available from all good and bad online retailers. Thank you so much, Lucy, and thank you so much, Laura. Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. Our next book club book is Booker Prize shortlisted Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These. It is 1985 in an Irish town. During the weeks leading up to Christmas, Bill Furlong, a coal and timber merchant, faces into his busiest season. As he does the rounds, he feels the past rising up to meet him and encounters the complicit silences of a people controlled by the church. The long-awaited new work from the author of Foster, Small Things Like These, is an unforgettable story of hope, quiet heroism, and tenderness. Give us a follow on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. We will see you next month for our Christmas special.